Thank you very much indeed, and good morning. I'm sorry that I missed the first part of this morning's session. I had to get up very early to catch an aeroplane because I was unable to come yesterday. Now, I have this topic, interim measures in English law and their circulation. We had a little bit of prior plotting put forward by Professor Bonomi so that we didn't overlap, and so I'm going largely to avoid discussing the contents of the Brussels-Lugano regime, though I'm happy to engage in discussion about that if people wish me to. What I propose to do is just to give you an overview on the kind of interim measures that we have in English law, because, as you will see, they somewhat avoid the attempt at systematization that we've heard about from Ilaria Pratelli, because we are an empirical tradition in the common law world. Then what we'll do is we'll look at freezing injunctions particularly and at anti-suit injunctions. And I can't resist saying something about Brexit and the effect of Brexit. I hope you will bear with me when we come to that. I'm going to... Brexit is a word that was invented by somebody who I think probably better remain nameless, because today's the day of European elections and we don't want to upset anybody. I'm going to confine myself to civil and commercial matters, partly because of time limits, but more importantly because I don't know anything about family law, really, and insolvency is another country altogether. So I will confine myself to that. Now, I will, in freezing injunctions, look first at the power to grant them. But before we do that, I should just say something about the very great width of interim measures, provisional protective measures that we have available in English law. They can have a coercive effect, they can have a restraining effect, or they can have a declaratory effect. So not so much a pair of dichotomies, as we heard from Ilaria, but three different overlapping objectives of these orders. And much the widest and most important is the injunctions, and that's what we're going to look at. You can have declarations on an interim basis. They're unusual. They can't be enforced in the same way as orders that are coercive or restraining. You can have interim orders for in relation to property, the delivery up of property, the detention of property, the preservation of property pending a resolution of a dispute about it. You can even have an interim order for the sale of perishable goods. And in international trade, that is not at all uncommon. If you have a cargo of pears and there's a dispute about whether or not the pears belong to one person or somebody's paid them or whether there are enough of them, best sell them, turn them into money, which is not quite so perishable, though you do sometimes wonder, then you can proceed with the litigation. You can have orders for the taking of samples and orders for the making of experiments. You can have interim payments of money or damages. It's not nearly as extensively used in English law as, for example, by comparison in French law, as I understand it. But it can be used, and it is particularly used in personal injury cases where a victim may need some immediate payment of money to help pay for their care, where there's not much doubt about liability, but there may be doubt about the extent of the damages recoverable. You get an interim payment. You can have an interim order making entry into land to effect property-related orders, and that is used in intellectual property cases. Slightly less these days, now that we have the ability to download contraband music and videos from the internet. In the days when all these things came on CDs and physical property, these orders were extensively used to raid a premises in order to seize the CDs or DVDs that were said to be a breach of the copyright of the owners. You can have interim orders for disclosure of information, the topic we were talking about before the coffee break. And you can have orders in aid of enforcement and on an interim basis. You can seize debts owed by third parties to the judgment debtor. You can attach assets in aid of enforcement on a provisional basis until the resolution of the issues about those are resolved. So you can see a very wide range of orders, and they find equivalent expression, I think, in many of the other civil procedure systems, which you'll be able to tell us about on the comparative law basis. Coming to injunctions then, the power to grant an injunction is very wide. It's granted in all cases in which it appears to the court to be just and convenient to do so. Note, it has to be both just and convenient. You can't have convenience without justice or justice without convenience. But that's a very wide power. It is, of course, restrained by a century or more of case law. That particular statutory provision dates back to the 1870s and indeed earlier in other forms, but it's constrained by case law. But that is the statutory provision. And it is supplemented in the case of freezing injunctions, or injunctions generally, by the civil procedure rules, where, say, the court may grant a number of interim measures. I've identified there an interim injunction. So, for example, you can restrain publication of defamatory material on an interim basis. That's quite common in the media world. And then you can have, specifically, you can have a freezing injunction restraining a party from removing from the jurisdiction assets located there, or restraining a party from dealing with any assets, whether located within the jurisdiction or not. And you can have an order directing a party to provide information about the location of relevant property or assets, or provide information about those assets, which may be the subject of an application for a freezing injunction. So it's a kind of institutionalized, not quite fishing expedition, but a disclosure order. And I'll look at that when I come to ancillary orders in a moment. But that's the statutory provision. Now, the purpose of these things is to preserve assets, but it's not to create security. You can't claim a priority by getting one of these freezing orders. And when we refer to freezing orders, those of you who have got longer memories will remember something called a Morava injunction. And this is exactly the same thing, except that now we don't call it a Morava injunction because we've put it on a statutory footing. It was originally the creation of case law. We've chosen a name for it which is not accurate, because it doesn't freeze the assets at all. What it does is it restrains, it operates in personam and not in rem, and it restrains the respondent to the order from dealing with the assets. That may have a freezing effect, but it's an indirect freezing effect. Its purpose is to satisfy a future judgment or award, or to enable the assets to be the subject of execution. As I say, it operates in personam, not in rem. There must be personal jurisdiction over the defendant. That's important. If you haven't got personal in personam adjudicatory jurisdiction over the defendant, you can't get one of these things. Having said that, well, we'll look in a moment at what that can amount to, but let's just see the history of it a little. Until 1975, it was thought that the court had no power to restrain the removal of assets from the jurisdiction before judgment. But then in two cases, of which Morava was the second, an order was made. It's interesting that the injunction took its name from the second one, Morava. The first one was a case called Karagiorgis, and it is said that the judge who heard the case said, "Don't call this a Karagiorgis injunction, it will never catch on." So they called it a Morava injunction. So personal jurisdiction over the defendant. Now, that's based on the old traditional equitable jurisdiction of the courts of chancery. By here, I use the term jurisdiction to mean subject matter jurisdiction, the power of the court to grant such an order. And it is the subject of discretion. Discretion, in my experience, is much misunderstood among my continental counterparts. It doesn't mean depends on what the judge had for breakfast. What it means is that you operate within a series of parameters that have been laid down by case law. And in recent times, it has been accurately described in our Supreme Court as an exercise in assessment rather than an exercise of discretion. But what you need to have is you need to have, on the substance of the case, what's termed a good arguable case. One of the topics I looked at briefly a year or two ago was a comparative study of standards of proof European law. I don't mean European community law, but in comparative law systems and in the Anglo-American system. And I found a very great dearth, an absence of learning on standards of proof at the interim stage in continental legal thinking. And I'm very interested to hear people's views about that. But there's a much more defined and refined set of criteria established in English law for the standard that has to be met at an interim stage for interim measures. And the phrase good arguable case is used in a number of contexts. In this context, it has to show that you've got a case that's not frivolous or vexatious, it's not too insubstantial, but it doesn't have to be so strong that at the interim stage you establish it on the balance of probabilities. So it's something in between the two of those. You have to show that there are assets within the territory. You have to show a real risk of assets being dissipated or secreted, and you have to consider that it's appropriate in all the circumstances. The language is just and convenient. The confining of the assets within the territorial jurisdiction is a characteristic of the simple form, if you can call it simple, of this injunction. There is a what we term a worldwide form of it, which we'll look at in a moment, but I thought I'd describe the basic form first. And it is enforced. Well, it is the provisional nature of it is secured by what's called an undertaking. The court would have no power under the law to direct a claimant to make good loss that is caused by an unjustified provisional or protective measure, because there's no provision in the law saying, well, you shouldn't have got this order, so you must pay compensation. So that same effect is obtained by only granting such an order to a claimant who gives an undertaking to the court to make good some loss of that sort. And if in due course it's found that the order should not have been granted, the court can enforce the undertaking by its powers of enforcement by saying, now you must make payments. And that defends not only the defendant, the respondent to the order, but also third parties who may suffer loss as a result of the order having been granted. So that's one of the sophistications. Incidentally, an undertaking is not required of the government. The government doesn't have to give one. I've tried to get one once against the government or against a public body, the Director General of Fair Trading, on the grounds that there was no reason to suppose they were any better at paying their debts than anybody else. But I was given very short answer by the court to that. The application is made without notice, and that carries with it, I mean, it's a unilateral ex parte procedure, it carries with it a duty of full and frank disclosure. It's the obligation of the claimant to draw to the court's attention any of the points that the defendant might make if the defendant had been there. And that's a very strong duty. And if you breach it, if you don't tell the court as much as you know, and sometimes things that you ought to know but don't know, the order can be set aside, even if it would otherwise be justified. And that happens sometimes. It happened to me in one case, but in extraordinary circumstances, but then the court immediately reimposed it. The only consequence was that my client ended up not getting some costs that she might otherwise have got. She was very happy nonetheless. There's a duty, once you've got one of these orders without notice, to provide copies to the respondent of anything you've said to the court, preferably a transcript of all the argument, of all the statements and material put before the court. In the absence of an actual transcript, you must provide a detailed note. It's the obligation of the lawyers to take and provide a detailed note of all that was said, both by the party making the application and by the judge, so that you can retroactively, as close as possible, recreate the circumstances in which the order was originally made when it comes to be reviewed. And once the order has been made on a without notice basis, and we talked about the need for service of it a little earlier on, the respondent has an opportunity to set it aside. Usually such an order will be made in the first place for a very short period, only a matter of days, and there will be what's called a return date within a very short period after that, giving the defendant an opportunity to come and say why the order shouldn't have been made. And that provides an opportunity for taking account of some of the defendant's objections. Sometimes there will then be an adjournment of the hearing for the matter to be determined. I referred to the good arguable case on the substance. That was laid down way back in the early 1980s in one of the leading cases on the case. It's not the same as a test used in a jurisdictional context, which was a good arguable case test, which means much the better of the argument. And there was some confusion about that, which was resolved 4 or 5 years ago. There was an argument for a long time that it had to be such an injunction could only be granted in support of an existing legal or equitable right. If you didn't have an underlying right that you could take to court and sue upon, you couldn't get the injunction. Now you could understand that, couldn't you? But the test has now been refined by our House of Lords, as it was, and an existing right is not essential. So, for example, a prospective right to contribution to a claim which you are denying. So a defendant, you're denying that you're liable to a plaintiff, but you go on and say, but if I am liable, then you, third party, respondent to my application, are liable to contribute. And so you can get an order prospectively freezing the contributing party's assets, even though you don't yet have a right, or you don't yet have a crystallized right upon which to base the claim for an injunction. It, as I say, usually but not always will be a cause of action, but it might be a future debt, it might be a potential rights contribution, something of that sort. But the point is that an injunction can't exist in isolation. And then you have to have assets within the jurisdiction, any kind of assets, although there's a very relatively recent case which says that merely a cause of action does not constitute property or assets for these purposes. If you have a prospective right to draw down under a loan facility, that might be a pure cause of action, or we call it a shows in action, but that would not constitute an asset sufficient to get a freezing injunction. And the assets either can be in the name of the defendant, including jointly owned ones, or they could be assets over which he has power, even if they are not nominally in his name, to attempt to avoid attempts at avoidance. And an assertion of third-party ownership will not be taken at face value. It will be investigated. These things are often used in fraud cases. Real risk of assets being dissipated or secreted. It won't prevent the justified disposal of assets. The order will say that the property, the subject of the injunction, must not prevent you from making payment of your debts in the ordinary course of business, so it won't put you out of business as such. And in the case of individuals, they get to keep their living expenses and ordinary debts, and then there's an exception to pay the legal expenses. You wouldn't get the lawyers to apply for one of these things unless they had an opportunity to be paid for their efforts. Just and convenient in all circumstances, that's a measure of assessment of the appropriateness of the order. Right, effect on third parties. One of the powerful things about a freezing order is its effect on third parties. And if a bank, for example, or some other third party is given notice of the order against the defendant, they are obliged not to do anything that would assist in a breach of the order. And so they themselves become subject, if subject to their being personally subject to the jurisdiction of the court, to comply with those orders. I'm going to hurry through these because I've got a number of other things to say. Ancillary orders. These orders now nearly always have ancillary orders attached to them, requiring a defendant to make full disclosure of their assets so that we know what assets are available, and to provide information as to the location of them and so forth. And if the claim is proprietary, that is to say that the claimant actually claims property rights over the assets in question, the powers are even wider. You can have a claim just for information from third parties to enable an action to be brought against a wrongdoer, where the third party is, and the phrase, mixed up in the wrong, so as to facilitate it. That phrase is used, and they must be able to provide the information. So it's they can amount to really quite stringent orders. Now, let's look at the internationalisation of the order. How does it operate in an international environment? Well, the first thing is that it's been extended to assets outside the jurisdiction, so that if the defendant is personally subject to the jurisdiction of the English court, you can restrain the defendant from disposing of his assets, whether they're territorially within England and Wales or not. And a failure to do that would amount to a breach of the order and be enforceable against the defendant and his assets. So it can restrain dissipation of those. And that's the term worldwide order that we use. It isn't always worldwide. That's a rather hubristic name for it, because often it can be confined to a more limited geographical area where you think they may have assets. But again, you need to show jurisdiction over the defendant, and you need to show an insufficiency of assets within the territory to satisfy the judgment, and you need to show a risk of assets elsewhere which may be dissipated. What I haven't talked about here in the internationalisation of the order, but I should mention it briefly, we're aware that Article 31 of Lugano, 35 of the recast, says that application may be made for such provisional or protective orders as may be available under the law of the member states in the absence of jurisdiction over the substance. But until the Brussels Convention came along, the English court had no power to award to make such an order against a person who was not otherwise subject to the jurisdiction in respect of the particular cause of action. So we enacted Section 25 of the Civil Jurisdiction and Judgments Act to give that power, and in the absence of jurisdiction over the substance, interim orders can be made in aid of proceedings elsewhere. Originally, it was confined to the Brussels Convention contracting states, but that and confined to causes of action within the subject matter jurisdiction of the Brussels contracting states. That has been widened over the years, and now it applies really in any circumstances, although the Brexit legislation is running a carving knife through all of that if it comes into effect, although the effect, I think, will be the same. Right. A point to make about something different, which is, you remember that under the enforcement provisions of Brussels 1, there's a provision that an enforceable judgment, these days in Brussels without exequatur and Lugano with exequatur, shall carry with it by operation of law the power to proceed to any protective measures which exist under the law of the member state addressed. And that means that where there is a judgment from another Brussels-Lugano country, an application may be made to the English court under this provision for one of these freezing orders. And that does sometimes happen. Right. Now, the other big thing, and it dates from the very earliest days of doing these injunctions, is there are provisos attached to the order which restrict its extraterritorial effect. And these are often not well understood. It's confined to the defendant and persons subject to the personal jurisdiction of the English court. It requires local sanction for the enforcement of the order abroad. You can't just phone up the huissier in Lausanne and say, please go and seize the assets. Although nowadays in other European Union member states, you would be able to do that under the no exequatur rule. But the scope of the English order is still confined to say it may not be enforced in other countries without local sanction. And then an exception to the order will be to say that it does not require you to do anything that is contrary to the local law of the place of enforcement. There are two provisions in the standard order that govern that international effect. The first of them is to confine it to say it doesn't extend to persons who are outside the jurisdiction of the court, except in the limited circumstances set out in the second one, which is the respondent, persons subject to the jurisdiction of the court, persons who have order, then cumulatively, 1, 2, and 3, persons who are subject to the jurisdiction, have been given written notice, and are able to prevent the acts or omissions. And thirdly, we have the provision on local enforceability I mentioned a moment ago. That's one, that's about persons outside England and Wales, and then the assets located outside England and Wales. Again, it requires local sanction. Now, anti-suit injunctions. Oh, I should say one further thing about these injunctions before I say anything further, which is to pick up a point made from this morning. There's no specific requirement of urgency. Ilaria Pratelli and with the backing of George Berman suggested that this is quintessential in such of these orders. And my response to that is to say, well, it depends what you mean by urgency. Prospective urgency. Something might not be urgent at the time you get the order. It only becomes urgent once the defendant knows you've got the order. And so if you make a prior condition of urgency, where it isn't urgent because the defendant has no idea you're about to swoop on his assets, then that frustrates the purpose of the order. So by urgency, you have to understand prospective urgency. the urgency that will arise when the defendant finds out that you've got one of these orders. And by that stage, it has to be effective, the surprise effect. I have already said, I think, anything I want to say on the subject of instrumentality. Right, anti-suit injunctions, a brief word about those. These are injunctions restraining a respondent from starting or continuing proceedings in a foreign court. There are a number of rules. There must be jurisdiction, must have a legitimate interest, and the conduct must be wrongful, in a sense. It must be, the most common example is where it's a breach of an exclusive jurisdictional arbitration clause to pursue the foreign proceedings. We know that in the European legal space, these are banned, first by Turner and Grovitt, and then by the West Tankers case, which I had the misfortune to lose on behalf of the UK government. Where there is an exclusive choice of forum, the court will ordinarily grant an injunction. You'll nearly always get one in those circumstances. In non-contractual cases, you have to, like Turner, you have to show conduct which is really an attempt to subvert the operation of the jurisdiction of the English court. They're not available, as I say, to restrain proceedings in Brussels Lugano cases. There is an interesting question about West Tankers, because West Tankers was a case where an anti-suit injunction was granted to restrain proceedings in Italy, which were brought, it was said, contrary to an exclusive arbitration clause in London. And so the anti-suit injunction had as its subject matter the protection of arbitration and fell outside the scope of the Brussels regulation, or convention, I think, at that point. So that's fine. But the reasoning of the European Court was that the doctrine of effectiveness as part of the wider European Union law meant that the European Union law could not be frustrated by the actions of a court in the United Kingdom, and therefore an anti-suit injunction was unlawful to restrain the court proceedings in Italy, notwithstanding that the subject matter of the English proceedings was arbitration. I put out a question to you, would that work in the Lugano context where you're not necessarily subject to the wider aspects of European law? So, a word about Brexit, and I'm sure I'm conscious I'm running out of time. On Monday, when I prepared this little slide, there were three realistic scenarios in place. One was that we will end up revoking Article 50 and remaining in the European Union. The second is that the withdrawal agreement that had been negotiated and approved by the Council in November last year will eventually be ratified by the English Parliament, together with the political declaration on the future relationship. And the third is no deal. Now, that was Monday. Here we are on Thursday. And during the course of yesterday, Wednesday, it became apparent that the second of those is now not going to happen. Because while the Prime Minister had proposed bringing forward the withdrawal agreement as a fourth attempt to get the Parliament to ratify it, the storm of political attacks on her that descended after she said that is such that she's clinging onto her job by her fingernails at the moment, and it's pretty clear that they're not now going to attempt to ratify that deal. What they're going to do instead, I have absolutely no idea, and if you read all the commentary out in the United Kingdom press and more widely, they have no idea either. If you talk to the parliamentarians, they have no idea. And so what we're going to do is we're going to send Parliament off on a two-week half-term break instead of getting on with thinking about it. That starts this afternoon. So those are the three scenarios. Remain simple, no change. We remain in the Lugano Convention and the Brussels One regime as at now. I'll go very quickly through the November deal because it isn't going to happen, but there was a provision for continuation of the status quo ante until December 2020, with recognition and enforcement of judgments given before the end of that period of 2020. The only real difference would be that we would have no continued right to make references to the Court of Justice for interpretative rulings, but that's... and you're aware, of course, that member states can make references under the Lugano Convention as well as under the Brussels regime. But, as I say, that's not going to happen. No deal. Well, at the beginning of this year, a whole raft of highly convoluted statutory instruments were produced by the government under very wide powers that they had given themselves under the EU Withdrawal Act to take account of what would happen upon Brexit. The starting point is that European law is carried over and domesticated. The entire acquis is carried over and domesticated, and that provision has been adopted into English law, and that is what will happen on exit day. But then the government gave itself powers to moderate the effect of European law where there were, quote, deficiencies, unquote, in European law. And it's pursuant to those powers that they've made a whole lot of statutory instruments. Now, where there was no need for reciprocity, as in the choice of law rules, for example, Rome 1 and Rome 2 will just carry on as before. But where you needed reciprocity in Brussels and indeed in the Lugano Convention, because the United Kingdom is a party to the 2007 Lugano Convention by virtue of being a member state of the European Union and not in its own right, then what these instruments do is they revoke all of that. They simply wipe it off the map. And they wipe off the old bits off the map too, the old Brussels Convention that might otherwise continue, the old 1988 Lugano Convention wiped off the map. It'll be an interesting question in the Court of Justice in some future date whether they are in compliance with their public international law obligations in doing that, but we can discuss the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties some other day. But they saved, for political reasons, the consumer and employment provisions on jurisdiction, which they took out and then stuck back in. The Hague Choice of Court Convention, again, we are party to it by virtue of being a member state of the European Union, but we are able to, and have given notice that we wish to, accede to it upon our leaving the European Union. That raises a question about the effect of choice of forum clauses that comply with the Choice of Court Convention, which are entered into before exit day, because the law under which they would be applicable in the United Kingdom would be European law, and they won't be, that law is law that has been revoked. And the clauses that are entered into after exit day will have effect in the United Kingdom. Well, that's all fine and large. In fact, what these instruments do, a different one relating to the Hague Convention, is they say, well, we will continue to respect the choice of forum clauses that are entered into before exit day, and if there's a hiatus between exit day and the day of the Hague Choice of Court comes into effect during that hiatus, we will respect clauses entered into at that time. It doesn't say anything about whether other states will respect clauses entered into in respect of the United Kingdom at that time and stay their proceedings in favour of the United Kingdom courts, where the United Kingdom is no longer bound by the European law to do that. So that remains that question. I've explained how jurisdiction is taken back. What we'll be left with? Well, we'll be left with our old domestic law. There were, including a slightly modified version of the power to grant interim measures in aid of proceedings elsewhere. But then there are some bilateral agreements we have with other countries. There are some old bilateral arrangements with seven different European countries, six EU members and Norway, but many, 20 others, we don't have them. We have bilateral arrangements with a small number of other countries around the world, Canada, Australia, Israel, one or two others. But exceptions for those will be back to the common law. And there's very restricted scope of recognition and enforcement under those bilateral arrangements and under the common law. It's only final money judgments, so none of these interim measures would be enforceable in England after Brexit if they're granted in other states. And it'll be for other member states and other states around the world to decide whether they would continue to give effect to interim measures granted by English courts. Just a footnote to that, we have never been party to the European Account Preservation Order, and so its operations do not apply in the United Kingdom and will not be carried over. But an order made under the EAPO in another member state probably falls within the definition of judgment under Brussels 1 and therefore would be enforceable under the Brussels 1 conditions, subject to having been served, as Ilaria pointed out a little earlier. We have the differences between Lugano and Brussels because you still require exequatur under Lugano. I'm conscious I've slightly overrun my time, but thank you very much indeed for your attention.